So the question I want to address today is what happens to black holes if you give up Lorentz symmetry? And most of the things I'll say are based on work together with Enrico Barause, who is now at IAPA in Paris, Ted Jacobson, who is sitting right there, my postdoc Ian Vega, who is still based in Trieste, in CISA, and my student Daniele Vernieri, who is also still at CISA. But it's all has been in, also has been influenced by Gisnu, my other postdoc, who is in the audience right there. So why is that an interesting question? So the causal structure of general relativity at the local level is that of special relativity. And the base of the causal structure of special relativity, as you all know, is the light cone. As you probably know from standard textbooks, we understand horizons and black hole spacetimes exactly by looking at null congruences and light cones at the local level. So normally, when you give up Lorentz symmetry, you expect to sort of give up this idea of the light cone. So it makes sense to wonder what will happen to black holes in this case, and whether theories that don't have Lorentz symmetry will or will not have black holes. So let me make that a little bit more concrete. Suppose that you have a theory in which has a preferred frame. There is some preferred observer. And you so it makes sense to only talk in terms of what this observer observes. And suppose that for this observer, there are different excitations traveling at different speeds. But they all have dispersion relations like this. Nice linear dispersion relations as you're used to. Then clearly, you could have modes that propagate faster than light. You could have modes propagating slower than light. But all modes will have a maximum speed if they have dispersion relations like that. So all modes are going to be restricted to propagate within some propagation cone. The propagation cone will have a wider or narrower angle than that of light, depending on how high the speed of these modes is. Well, I'm just saying that light will be one of these modes, so it will, you know, it will also have a linear dispersion relation, right? And you know, very intuitively and naively thinking, that would be the situation that you would expect if I have a theory, some sort of effective theory, which is not necessarily Lorentz invariant. I truncate it at the level of second order operators. I would expect that it will give me linear dispersion relations, so the picture would be roughly that. So there would still be propagation cones. What would that mean for the structure of what you would call a black hole, right? What could you do? So what you see here is just the typical Schwarzschild space-time diagram with null lines drawn on it and future-pointing light cones. And you probably all remember that a way you're taught at university what a horizon is somebody tells you, look, the light cones start tilting up to the point where essentially one side of the light cone becomes vertical in this diagram, and everything that propagates to the future has to move inwards, and that marks the event horizon. Now, if you imagine overlaying a second set of propagation cones, which are wider than the first, right, you would actually have to tilt them a little bit more so that their side, yes? Sure, sure. Yeah, that's fine, that's fine. Yeah, but it would be best if you let me get first to the inner one, describe what it is, and then you can raise your objections. Okay, so if I had a wider propagation cone, then the modes with this propagation cone would not be able to go inside the surface, but the other ones would. They would have their own surface like that, a little bit further inside. And as it was already said, from the point of view of, you know, up until which point am I causally connected with, I would have to take the innermost of those as the horizon, essentially. And the same argument goes if I have the narrower propagation cone, I would actually end up having another surface for modes that propagate slower than light, would be sitting somewhere here, for instance. And that would be you know, whatever these specific modes could causally relate to.
What about speed of light?
Sorry?
Speed of light.
I'm assuming that the speed of light is the speed of light, some finite speed. It doesn't have to be. I'm just building a heuristic picture here. The speed of light has some speed, call it c, has some number. Some other field travels at some speed faster than that, essentially. Some other at some speed lower than that. So the point is that this picture is clearly not complete, because it very much relies on my assumption that the various modes have linear dispersion relations. So it does rely on the fact that I somehow assume that there is, for it, even for modes that travel superluminally, there is a maximum speed they can reach. And you don't have to do that. You could have, for instance, a dispersion relation like that. You could go stick there in a term like that goes like k to the fourth. And then if you go to sufficiently large k's, you could practically have infinite speeds. So these propagation cones now don't really exist. If I had dispersion relations like this, propagation cones don't really exist. And assuming that I'm using large enough k's, mode with large enough k, I could actually go everywhere, penetrate all of the would-be horizons that I talked about before. And in this picture, if you just try to take it at face value, you realize that if I have an event p, essentially I'll have some sort of surface of simultaneity which is all the points I can reach like that at the same time, and everything that lies north of the surface sort of lies in the future. Everything that lies south of the surface is in the past. And that's the typical pre-relativistic causal structure that you would expect, right? And so it becomes a little bit hard to see where would the black hole, the notion of a black hole, fit in this picture. And that's exactly what I want to discuss today. So That's the motivation of it, and I think it's an interesting question in two ways. First of all, because black holes are intrinsically very interesting objects which we are trying to understand. And so one might want to understand them in theories that violate Lorentz symmetry. Note that the value of A for this intuitive picture was really relevant. I could make that as tiny as I want, and all that will change is how high energies do I need to probe beyond that horizon. But technically, I would always be able to do it, right? The other important aspect of that is it might actually also tell us something about Lorentz symmetry and theories that don't have Lorentz symmetry, because of course, black hole is the typical solution of GR, where you see this, you know, in its full glory, the peculiar causal structure of general relativity. So how do we do it? Well, the good thing is, nowadays, we actually have theories which allows us to answer this question beyond the heuristic level that I just showed to you. One of them is the Einstein ether theory. So it's essentially general relativity with a vector field. You write all of the terms in the action that are quadratic in the first derivatives of this vector field. And you force a vector field to satisfy a unit time-like constraint. So this vector always has to be unit time-like, much like a four velocity, right? And these are the various terms that you can write, the various contractions of the two derivatives that you can write. So there are four parameters from C1 to C4. This theory was put together by Ted Jacobson and David Mattingly, and I believe that the main motivation for putting it together is to have a Lorentz-breaking theory of gravity, which is well-defined. And you can go and you can confront with observations and see how much Lorentz symmetry could we afford to have in the gravity sector without violating any experiments, right? And so you can see how this theory violates Lorentz symmetry at the level of every solution. You always have to satisfy this unit constraint. So go locally, the metric will be flat. The vector cannot go to zero. So it will be a unit vector point in a time-like direction. It will pick a preferred time direction for you. Now, people have extensively tested this theory, and for a certain range of, in this parameter C1 to C4, this is a viable theory. It passes solar system tests. It gives sensible phenomenology elsewhere. it propagates a spin two, spin one, and a spin zero mode. So a standard graviton plus two more modes. Both of these modes, all three modes actually, can travel at a different speed than the speed of light. And by the speed of light, I mean I take matter, I couple it minimally to the metric that I had just written before, and then I get the standard speed of light for that. So all of these three speeds can be different than the speed of light, and they depend.
So you have three light
codes. Yeah, I have four actually. Three propagation cones for this, and the actual light cone for light. Right? And I could tune, if I want, one of the, you know, some of the speeds to be equal to the speed of light by tuning these parameters, but essentially I don't have to do that. In general, the theory around flat space has linear dispersion relations, like what I just discussed before. So it's an example of that type. So if I were to go and find black holes in this theory, I would expect to see these multiple horizons. Right? I would have, by black holes in this context, I mean, I would go find some solution which has a killing horizon, which would be an event horizon as far as my photons are concerned. And then I'd expect to see these other horizons that act as horizons for the rest of the modes.
Am I allowed to have non-trivial couplings of the vector to curvature tensors?
The couplings of the theory is defined in the way I showed you before. So all of the terms that I'm allowing are written here.
So I can't have things like, say,
it's the most general thing you can write that leads to second order derivatives.
So I can always just commute them.
I mean, there is, if that's what you're asking, there is, you could write the term Ricci tensor U mu U nu, but that's like just a total divergence away from the terms you have. So it's not something new.
Technical question. If you're three different speeds, C, this affects the metric. The S squared equals C squared to T squared. G node contains C squared, so you have three metrics. See what I'm saying?
I could define a three metrics. I could certainly see the problem as having each one of these degree of freedom seeing an effective metric in its propagation, which is different than the other one. I mean, you could see that in this way, but you don't have to.
The second issue is you have to do a variation of principle.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to vary the C's and the G's to get through the equation. How do you do that? Because you're violating the principle.
The C's are constant, right? They're parameters of the theory. My C's are just constants. The dynamical field is the metric and the vector field U. I vary with respect to the vector field. I get an equation for the vector field.
So the C's are kept constant?
Yeah, they're just constant. So, what I was saying is that in this theory, you expect to see this structure of multiple horizons. Clearly, this is a purely classical, second order theory. It's actually a good effective field theory for a vector field breaking the boost part of Lorentz symmetry. In the sense, it's the most general thing you can write. But you could expect that if there were to be any UV completion of that type, clearly the dispersion relations would not remain linear because there is no reason, there is no symmetry preventing them from acquiring higher order corrections. So take now this, the theory that I just gave you, and add an extra assumption. Assume that your ether field, your UA, is actually hypersurface orthogonal. So locally, you can write it always in terms of a scalar, which I call T, and I've suitably normalized it to absorb the fact that U is a unit vector. Right? Then the fact that U is always unit time-like means that this scalar always has a time-like gradient, right? So it actually makes a good time coordinate. And I could choose to use part of my gauge freedom to put myself in this gauge where T plays the role of time. That essentially amounts to introducing a foliation by constant T hypersurfaces. And if I do that, then the ether just becomes the lapse of this foliation that I just introduced times a Kronecker delta. And if I stick that back in the action, the Einstein ether action, then the action takes this form, where this is the extrinsic curvature of the leaves of the foliation, H is the induced metric on the leaves, And this is just a correspondence of constants between what I call here lambda, xi, and eta, and whatever scale is sitting outside my action with the ones I had written before. You're saying that you can couple U with a matter. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, of course, that's true. That's true. That's true. I mean, it's the action that I gave you before didn't contain any matter, right? So in this respect, I don't have any other fields. That's the most general one. Once I couple it to matter, clearly I can choose to couple U to matter or not. So if I essentially observations tell me that I shouldn't, because if I should, all you know, I'd get very, very large Lorentz breaking in the matter sector, which is very well tested, right? So clearly, to meet phenomenology in the sense of absence of Lorentz breaking in the matter sector, you need to have some way in which your ether will not couple to the matter. You need to find some reason why your ether will not couple to the matter. From a purely classical perspective, I can just do that by choosing to couple the matter only to the metric in the minimal coupling principle, and that will be fine. Quantum corrections are not generically expected to respect that. There are some ideas about how to do that, but Maxim has most of them. But I won't get into this now. Sorry? Yeah, in a sense, you don't see it through the matter. Yeah, you don't see it in the matter. The matter doesn't know about it. Yeah, I'm hiding part of the problem, certainly, yeah. But in any case, I mean, I don't want to get into this because that doesn't really matter for what I'm going to use these theories for now. I just want to get vacuum solutions of these theories and see how they behave. So I was at the point where I was saying that if you make this extra assumption before the variation, you know, at the level of choosing what your fundamental fields are, I can write the action in this way. And this action now is, let's call it the low energy part of Horava-Lipschitz gravity. So Horava-Lipschitz gravity is this action here supplemented by two sets of fourth order and sixth order terms in spatial derivatives only. So what I've done now is I've introduced this foliation. I've split my space-time into space and time. So I now have a well-defined way to go and add extra spatial derivatives without adding extra time derivatives. And essentially, what should go in here should be all of the terms that are compatible with the symmetries that I have left. So I've introduced a foliation. So I've break diffuse to some extent. How much? Well, I have all the diffuse that respect the foliation that I've introduced. And that I can go and construct all the terms that need to go there that respect the symmetry. That's a lot of terms. That's like about 60 terms or so, right? Again, that's not going to concern me here. It's not going to concern me because all I want you to keep from the presence of these terms is that the dispersion relation is going to change in the way I told you before. I'm going to go here and stick some fourth order spatial derivatives. I'm going to go here and stick some sixth order spatial derivatives. So clearly, the dispersion relation is going to cease to be linear. It's going to be of the type I gave you before. It's going to have higher order corrections, which will lead to this behavior. I take a mode which is sufficiently short wavelength, essentially, and it can propagate as fast as I want, right? So that's
what's M star?
M star is some characteristic scale that suppresses these operators. Well, you can stick it in by hand, but clearly, you know, infrared viability actually will give you constraints on that. But let's not get into this because it's a long discussion and we're not going to have time to talk about the things we. I'm happy to talk about it afterwards. Yeah. It does. So when you make this assumption that the vector is hypersurface orthogonal, you essentially kill the spin one degree of freedom, and you only have the spin zero. So that's really a different theory than Einstein ether theory. It's just that The nice thing about it is that following the step backwards, you're just writing this theory in a fully covariant manner, right? So it's practically the opposite of Stueckelberging it. You can Stueckelberg the theory in this way by following the steps backwards.
It's more than a Stueckelberg.
Sorry?
It's more than a Stueckelberg.
No. Without adding the degree of freedom, what I'm saying is I take that theory here. That is a theory with a preferred foliation, right? If I follow these steps backwards, I'm never giving up the assumption. But I can just write it in a fully covariant way, So that's practically your Stueckelberg field, if you want to view it this way. Yeah. So it's good that you asked this question because essentially this is a theory with a preferred foliation. You can write it in the preferred foliation, right? Or you could use this prescription to write it in a covariant manner, in which case, at the level of every solution, the configuration of T would actually define for you what is the preferred foliation. So T would be the time as measured by the, the time of the preferred foliation, okay? So I already said a part of that. So essentially, the need to have the L4 and the L6 terms is because it improves the UV behavior. Right? That's why you have these terms there in Horava gravity. And as I said, in principle, you should consider all of the terms that are compatible with the symmetry. Again, from a low energy perspective, which is what will concern me here, this action is still makes a viable theory for appropriate choices of the parameters lambda, xi, and eta, essentially, in the sense that it has sensible weak field limit, it doesn't have any mode that has negative energy or has gradient instabilities in flat space, and so on and so forth. Right. Okay, so the plan is to use these two theories essentially to try to get a first answer to the question I posed in the beginning, right? And the easiest way to do it is what we did with Enrico and Ted, is to consider spherically symmetric static and asymptotically flat black holes, which is the easiest case you can imagine. And there is an added bonus to that because spherically symmetric vectors are hypersurface orthogonal. So you expect then that all solutions of Einstein ether theory, which contains this vector, will have to have a vector that is hypersurface orthogonal just because you impose spherical symmetry, and therefore will be solutions of Horava gravity as well. It's not automatic that the inverse holds true, that it's the full spectrum of solutions and that you don't have extra solutions in Horava that are not Einstein ether solutions, because you impose the condition before the variation of hypersurface orthogonality. But actually, it has been shown that's true for asymptotically flat solutions. So you can hit two birds with one stone. You find essentially the solutions in one theory, they will be the same in the other one. And now, if you go and you can treat this problem in a sense of, it's like solving an initial value problem, in R, where R plays the role of your time, right? When you have spherical symmetry, you have enough symmetry to deal with a problem like that. And it's very hard to find solutions analytically, but you can find them numerically with this technique. So you can go and work out, you can write the system of equations of Einstein ether theory or Horava gravity in as a set of constrained equations that would relate initial data on an R equal constant hypersurface, and dynamical equations which evolve you away from that hypersurface, and you generate your solution by an R step every time. And if you do that, you can go and count how many pieces of initial data you have, and when you evolve in the future, how many conditions do you need to satisfy, like asymptotic flatness, for instance, and you can figure out how many parameters your solutions will have. And if you play this game, you see that the generic family of solutions has two parameters. So roughly speaking, the mass and something else. That something else would be the ether hair of the solution. However, another interesting thing that you find when you look at these solutions is that they tend to be generically singular on the spin one horizon, on the spin zero horizon, on what would be the horizon of your spin zero mode. So they have a finite area singularity that is in principle accessible by your spin zero mode. if you want the solution to be regular everywhere apart from the center, like your Schwarzschild spacetime, you have to impose an extra condition of regularity on this spin zero horizon. And if you do that, you do get a nice one parameter family of solution with a parameter being the mass, essentially. Which means that whatever ether hair you had, you kind of fixed it to have a special relation with a mass in order to kill the singularity. So these are the kind of solutions we were after. And that's what this assumption here means, everywhere regular apart from the central singularity. Okay? So yeah. Are you referring to the solution without the singularity?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, these are perfectly fine. Actually, this is not even a singularity. This is not even a singularity in the metric. It's actually singularity in the ether, on that surface. Which, on the other hand, since the spin 0 degree of freedom doesn't see that effect, you know, that effective metric. It sees an effective metric which contains the ether, as perceived by the spin zero metric. The spacetime would be singular, but it's a singularity in the ether in the initial formulation. So it's not a curvature singularity in this respect.
You get a Schwarzschild-like
measure. Yeah, of course. I'll talk about that. Yeah.
So you have an additional dimensional parameter, which is the mass of black hole divided by M star.
Oh, there is no M star. Sorry, that was my fault. I mean, there is no M star because all of this discussion is held by looking at, as I said, I look at the low energy part. So it's like sending M star to infinity, or just not considering the higher order operators, right? No, I don't have that coefficient. I'm not considering that at all, right? Let's go back. So I'm considering this action, or that action truncated here, essentially. So I'm not taking into account these terms. I want to find the low energy solution and discuss later on what would actually happen if I were to add any extra stuff.
Just one point. So do you think it's called the static solution? Because I mean, I guess the ether is actually falling.
Yeah, that's fine. But they're static in the sense that they have a time-like healing vector.
They have a time-like healing vector. But like in the stationary
would be static. Yeah, they are spherically symmetric. I mean, they have all the killing symmetries that the static solution we have in GR.
But U mu is not.
Yeah, but I mean, you have a fair point that you know what is static. The ether can't be really static. It has to be in falling. And
so the
definition of staticity is a bit more subtle. But I mean. You stick to the covariant picture just tells you the definition in the sense of you're saying, okay, I'm putting myself in the covariant picture. I'm asking the solution to have certain killing symmetries and I call that static in the same way that I call it in GR. Yeah.
But I mean, the other analogy would be that to accretion, Fermi accretion in astrophysical objects. That if you put, say, black hole or a star in some gas, it's going to start falling into the black hole or a star. And there would be a sonic point. And indeed, there are multiple solutions that are singular except for one that goes through the sonic point. And I mean, in some sense, you could say this is accretion of ether into a black hole.
The thing is, you can't have a black hole solution where the ether is not infalling.
Right.
Because you've actually asked the ether to be time-like. So if you would also ask it to not be infalling, it would actually have to align with the killing vector. The killing vector becomes null on the horizon, on the killing horizon.
The horizon becomes a singularity.
Yeah, the defoliation ends there, practically. So you can go past that.
If you break Lorentzian arrays, then you've broken the homogeneous Lorentz group, so 3,1.
I'm breaking the boost only, not the rotations.
You're breaking the boost.
Yeah.
So you have all three symmetry, rotation symmetry left.
Yeah.
What does that do?
What it does in the usual case, I mean, essentially the theory has been constructed in such a way to not respect boosts, but to respect rotations. Yeah, exactly. I have a preferred time, but without necessarily having a preferred spatial direction. So, So yeah, we found these solutions. I mean, we found them numerically, so probably to the dismay of the people there that would prefer to hear some details about the numerics. I'm not going to talk about that at all. Also, the exterior of these solutions is very much like a Schwarzschild space-time. So I'm not going to talk about that either today, because I want to focus on the interior, right? So if you go, what I mean by the interior is, by definition, I call these black hole solutions. Somebody should have stopped me and said, why did you call them black hole solutions? What I mean by black holes in this limited context is they have a killing horizon, right? The matter that I would couple minimally to this theory would see that as a horizon at this naive level. So if I go and look at the interior of that, essentially, if I go close to r equals 0, I find the usual singularity. You can go and calculate curvature invariants, and they will diverge, right? And the real question now is, these solutions have this preferred foliation, right? It either because it's intrinsic in Horava gravity, or because in Einstein ether theory, I have the ether defining a preferred frame, but when the ether is hypersurface orthogonal, it actually defines a foliation because it's always normal to some set of hypersurfaces. They have this preferred foliation, and the question is, what does this foliation do in these solutions? So what you can do is you can go and take the dot product between the ether and the normal to the r equal constant hypersurfaces, which are essentially constant aerial coordinate hypersurfaces. And that's what you see plotted here for one of these solutions. Generically, you get this oscillation, essentially. That's the boost angle between the two vectors. So generically, you get this oscillation. The details of this oscillation are not that important. What you should keep from this graph is all in this little tiny corner here. So I'm starting the horizon. There is the two vectors are not aligned, right? And they get aligned very soon after. So the ether essentially aligns with a normal to the r equal constant hypersurfaces. And what does that mean? That means the ether is by definition normal to this capital T equal constant surfaces, because these are the foliation leaves, right? So it essentially tells you that one of the leaves of this foliation becomes an r equal constant surface. Also, the ether points in one direction of that, you know, with respect to that leaf, and that's the future in this theory. So it essentially tells you that if you're going to propagate into the future, we can only penetrate this r equal constant surface in that direction, in that direction where the ether points to, and not in the other one. So that, in every sense of the word, is a causal boundary, is a horizon for you, which is not a horizon for some mode, which propagates at some speed, right? It's just dictated by future pointedness, essentially, of your motion, without even having to refer to a propagation cone. And that's what you can see here. Well, you can't really see it graphically. There are a lot more lines in this graph. It's just too, you know. Yeah, if you look at my computer, there are at least three more lines here. Somehow they're too light to appear. But anyways, suppose that you had the, so these green lines are the leaves of this. So these green lines are the leaves of this foliation. They get darker as you go forward in time, and that's a very well-defined operation. And so you're suppose mentally draw one more leaf. Just indulge me in that. So there is one more of these surfaces going like that. Suppose that you send a signal sitting in one of these surfaces, and suppose that you let it travel as fast as you like. The only causal constraint, in a sense, then, is that you'll find it in a darker green surface, because you have to find it in the future. And that's the only constraint. And if you leave it there, then it's clear that you can find it pretty much everywhere, because there are dark greener hypersurfaces spanning all of the rest of the space. That's not the same if you emit it here. If you're going to go to a darker green surface, it can never be somewhere in the exterior of this red line. And this red line is this special leaf of the foliation that becomes an r equal constant surface. So that's what we call the universal horizon, because essentially it's a horizon for any mode irrespective of how fast it propagates, right? Now, we found that in our simulations. We also found independently by Diego Blass and Sergei Sibiryakov by doing the decoupling limit, So essentially, they took Horava gravity. They assumed that the scalar field, the ether, essentially, doesn't back react into the space-time. So they just solved the equation for the scalar field that defines the foliation on a Schwarzschild background. And they found the same behavior. So it's already there at decoupling. And this is a Penrose diagram, the Schwarzschild-Penrose diagram, with the leaves of the foliation drawn on it. And this is the universal horizon as an R equal constant surface, right? So clearly, as already asked, I have not included the higher order operators of Horava gravity. But that gives you a very good indication that even if I did, in principle, that these infinitely fast propagating modes wouldn't manage to cross this horizon outwards, actually, as long as it's there. And I don't have any reason to believe that including these terms will make it not be there, because this scale M star is going to be a relatively high energy scale, right? And this feature here is sitting actually very far from the singularity and very close to the standard event horizon, where the curvature is not large, the foliation is not doing anything funny per se, right? Of course, this is to be verified. You have to take it with a pinch of salt. But what I'm telling you is that already in the low energy theory, there is a feature which gives you a new definition of a black hole. Even if you would allow your modes to travel infinitely fast, you would still have a sensible definition of a black hole through this universal horizon. Now, there is a question actually already raised by Diego and Sergei, which is what they did that we didn't do is that they perturbed around this horizon, always within this decoupling limit. And they found linear perturbations to be behaving appropriately. But they also found that there is a little piece in this linear perturbations which is only killed because you impose boundary, regular boundary conditions at infinity. So that is a little bit worrisome, because if you try to go to the nonlinear level, you start wondering whether this term will be sourced if you don't kill it by boundary conditions. So that's, it's a potential indication for a nonlinear instability, which definitely needs to be looked into. I think they consider general perturbations, yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they didn't do the evolution, no. So there's definitely more work to be done there. That's something definitely worth exploring. And the first step is to see if it survives going beyond the decoupling limit. Because essentially, even if there exists a nonlinear instability in their calculation, it just tells you that you can't trust the decoupling limit, because whatever stress energy tensor the ether would have would just grow and would violate your decoupling approximation. The decoupling limit is essentially you're ignoring the back, in this context, you can just think about it as ignoring the back reaction of the ether on the space-time. So I keep the space-time fixed, it's Schwarzschild, and I just solve the ether equation on it, right? So if you find that the ether is growing, you clearly can keep ignoring its back reaction to the space-time. You somehow have to see if there is a... So what I'm saying is that you go and check how the perturbations behave, and when you go and you see that there is a piece in these perturbations, which if you impose the standard asymptotic boundary condition, so you ask it to vanish asymptotically, you kill it. Yeah, I have to think to make sure if these arguments apply, right? Because I mean, what they're really saying is that there is a piece in this perturbation that it's not a question of decaying or not decaying. It's practically killed by boundary conditions, and if you don't kill it, it's just non-analytic on some part of your space time.
Generic wave they became fast enough, then linearized stability implies no linear stability. But if
yeah, okay, you have to.
Then you're generically, that's not going
to be. I see what you mean. Yeah, you have to look at the You have to look at the system more carefully than what they've done to do that. And I think it's going to be crucial as well to first. My gut feeling is the problem will still be there beyond decoupling. I mean, even if you don't assume the decoupling. But at the moment, the result is too restrictive for my taste, because you're not allowing the metric to react to this. And maybe that's going to solve the problem or mitigate it or change its character. I mean, you can look at the equations. But the full system will have a different set of equations. So. Not really. No, I mean this is more of a Cauchy horizon-like instability, I would say. It's more like I would think that it's more like an instability that happens in the Cauchy horizon of like a Riesen-Ohrstrom or a Kerr black hole. That's a good question. I mean, in a sense, assuming, I mean, within the context of our assumptions, these solutions are unique, right? So, but I mean, you could say that's why I said, okay, it's like a Cauchy instability, because I mean, the indications are that the inner horizon of Kerr, for instance, is unstable. But again, what is the final state of that? You don't know, because again, this is all the solution the equations give you, which are black holes with these symmetries. So the final state might be that this surface just turns singular, and you get a finite area singularity there, right? In which case, the universal horizon doesn't exist, clearly, and the structure is very different. So that's, I don't know, Ted, do you have a different intuition?
My guess is that it's singular, but I
don't know. Yeah, OK. Yeah, I would guess the same, that if the instability is there, then it's singular, and there is no universal horizon. So that's what you would need to check.
The universal fireball.
Didn't the Smokshire solution is a unique solution? There is only one. How many vacuum solutions do you have?
So with the assumption that I said, and assuming that it's a black hole solution, these solutions are unique. Exactly, for a given mass. If I weren't assuming that it's a black hole solution, then so there is nothing equivalent to a Birkhoff's theorem, because you have this spin zero mode, right? So I mean that can give you different solutions. But so that's a spherical case. You could start saying, okay, the ether is in Einstein ether theory. Defines a foliation only in the spherically symmetric case. Spherical symmetry is too much symmetry. What happens? So you could actually start by looking at slowly rotating black holes. I mean, really rotating black holes is pretty hard to get. So you could look at slowly rotating black holes. And the way you usually do that is you start from these well-known ansatz where F and B are your spherically symmetric seed solution. And you can argue that this is the most general slowly rotating solution you can generate out of that. Then the function you need to determine is this omega of r and theta, the GD phi component of the metric. And the way this works in GR is you assume that your background solution is a Schwarzschild solution, for instance. You plug this ansatz in your Einstein's equations, and you get this one nice equation here. And this is an equation you can solve. And for instance, you get a slowly rotating limit of the Kerr solution out of that. One thing to take home from this slide is that the omega equals constant solution is always there, because it's just your initial solution in a different coordinate system. So when you get to omega equals constant, it's just the initial solution that you had. It doesn't have to be zero. Now, if you want to do the same here, you don't only have to make an ansatz for the metric, you would also have to make an ansatz for your ether field, right? And if you assume that your black holes, are, as I was assuming, are stationary and axisymmetric, essentially, in the coordinate system that I am, this means that my components don't depend on time and phi. And if I were now to impose as an extra assumption that my ether is hypersurface orthogonal, right, then I would also get that the u phi component has to be zero. Now, what does this assumption mean? In Horava gravity, it's there. I don't, that doesn't mean anything for me. I mean, it's not an assumption. It's a characteristic of the theory, essentially, as I just told you. If I impose it in Einstein ether theory, it just means that I'm looking at the subset of solutions that have a hypersurface orthogonal ether. So I look at the solutions which are, which admit a global foliation, essentially. So suppose that I do that, then I can argue that the most general ether I can write down takes this form to first order in rotation, which actually means that it's unchanged. It doesn't receive any first order contribution in the rotation. And that's already interesting because it tells you, you know, whatever solution you'll generate, it will essentially be foliated in the same way that the spherical one was foliated. So if you had a universal horizon before, right, you'll have it later as well, once you generate the slowly rotating solution, provided that it exists.
Would you expect this
conclusion
to hold at all orders?
No, no, no. You mean all orders in no, 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 definitely. No, no, no. No, it doesn't. Yeah, no, no, no. It doesn't hold at all orders. It's just a property of the slowly rotation, of the slow rotation. Actually, I can't even assume that at all orders. You know, that doesn't even imply that if I'm not working in slow rotation. Maybe I should have said that, right? Now, yeah, so if you plug now this back into this answer in the solutions of Einstein ether theory, you actually get only one solution, omega equals constant, which is the initial solution you had, right? Whereas if you plug it in the solution, in the equations of Einstein, of Horava gravity, you get a nice expression for omega, which is essentially the same that you get from GR, practically, right? Modulo this function B of R, which gives you the GT phi component of the metric, right? So what does that mean? Well, essentially, it means that Einstein ether theory doesn't admit any solutions with a hypersurface orthogonal ether once you turn on rotation. Right, the ether prefers to become non-hypersurface orthogonal, which is fine. Whereas Horava gravity admits the solution I just showed you, and this shows that there is essentially sort of bifurcation in the solution space. The two theories had the same spherically symmetric solution, but when I turn on rotation, Einstein ether goes one way, Horava goes the other one. In Horava gravity, solutions always need to admit a foliation because it's a characteristic of the theory. In Einstein ether, such solutions don't seem to exist, at least in the slowly rotating limit, and the ether always wants to be non-hypersurface orthogonal.
But I thought you showed that they were identical at the level of the Lagrangian.
No, 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 they were not identical at the level of the Lagrangian. I just saw that if I make the assumption that the ether is hypersurface orthogonal before the variation, yeah, right? Or the solutions blow up, right? So there are two choices.
Oh, that wasn't an aspect of your paper.
You should read the rest of the paper. You comment on that, right, in your paper, in the slowly rotating solution limit between the two theories. He's referring to your undoing the twist paper.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's not a regular.
But I think you can see it from the equations. I mean, you have the equations in your paper, actually. I think.
Yeah.
You can see from the equations that if you try to take the parameter that identifies to infinity, which is what would give you the Horava solution from the Einstein ether solution, mm-hmm. right? Then the solution you had in, is that what you're showing, that the solution blows up? No, there is no contradiction in the sense that, this solution doesn't have a limit, but another one pops up. I mean, it is.
I guess I'm just wondering whether you have to make an special assumption when you say there is no. I guess you're saying there is no Einstein in the theory. Is that what you're saying?
My statement is that there is no slowly rotating solution in Einstein ether theory, which admits a global foliation, essentially. So where the ether is everywhere in the solution, hypersurface orthogonal, right?
That makes sense.
That's my statement. We haven't explored that yet. We're trying, but we're not there yet.
So I guess it could be that as you make Twist parameter go to infinity, then it becomes more and more hypersurface.
So the last thing I want to talk about in the last 5 minutes is the newer results. So what I have in this slide is essentially Horava-Lipschitz gravity in three dimensions. So that's the action for Horava-Lipschitz gravity in three dimensions. The theory is much more tractable because it has a lot less terms, right? We started in this paper with Matt Visser and Sidke Weinfurter, and it's in three dimensions, it's an interesting theory because it has a scalar degree of freedom, which is a propagating degree of freedom. It behaves very much like the scalar degree of freedom in the full four-dimensional theory, right? So you can view it as an interesting theory of you know, the scalar field living in a curved space-time, which is foliated in a certain way. And it's a good toy model for many open questions in Horava gravity, including, you know, quantization, running of couplings, and all that stuff. So you could think of using it to go and find three-dimensional counterparts of the solutions that I just said. And that's what we did with Ian and Daniele. So the paper is supposed to come sometime in the next few days on the archive. What we wanted to do, what we thought to do is we said, okay, let's go and find the Lorentz breaking, essentially, generalization of the BTZ black hole. We just try to find a black hole solution with ADS asymptotics, right? And we expect that to exist because in TR it exists. So if you go and do that, the first thing you can show relatively easily is that no solutions with ADS asymptotics exist in the theory, unless you set one of the parameters to zero, this eta parameter. Eta is, let me go back to the action. So eta is this parameter here that multiplies the square of this acceleration term, right? In terms of the Einstein ether theory, it would be C1 plus C4. Okay. No, but these are three-dimensional black holes, not four-dimensional. So in three-dimensional black holes, you can do that, right? If you take the BTZ black hole, you can separate the boundary from the horizon as much as you want. Okay. That's the issue here as well. So what I was saying is, in general, what you find, and you can prove that relatively easily, that unless you set this eta to zero, you just can't support ADS asymptotics, essentially. There's no solution that supports that. And that's a bit sad, because setting eta to zero is a very special value. Eta to zero means that I'm essentially taking this spin zero degree of freedom that I have, and I make it propagate infinitely fast in flat space. So it's going to be a peculiar theory. It's not going to have the same properties as the other one. On the other hand, in this context, it's still interesting in a sense, because you know exactly what you're doing. You're taking this mode, you make it propagate infinitely fast. So in the context of the solutions that I showed before, you're pushing its horizon all the way to this universal horizon, if this exists, right? If it doesn't, you're allowing it to probe all the way to the singularity. Yeah, it is different. The limit of the projectable theory is eta going to infinity, not to zero. Because then you're lifting this term to a constraint, and you're just forcing the lapse to be always a function of time.
Wait, you still have an issue instead you want to just work with the projectable theory, would there be solutions in this case, or would you?
The projectable theory works very differently in this respect. I mean, so I don't want to get into that because it will spoil our intuition. I mean,
the
well, I'm not entirely sure because the eta going to infinity limit might be tricky, but okay. I mean, you might be right. So if you stick with this assumption, you can go and find solutions, and they're quite manageable. So you get this metric here. These are fully rotating solutions. So you get this metric here where F squared takes this form, which to those of you that know, it's very, very reminiscent of BTZ. It's practically formally the same thing. The main difference with a BTZ black hole is that whatever constant is sitting on your angular part is not the same one that you have here. So this J bar is defined in this way in terms of J and some ether parameters. So on this spacetime, there is an ether leaving or a foliation, which is given by that. And generically, it's determined by two extra parameters. So you have 3 plus 2, 5 parameter family of solutions. So that's a very rich set of solutions, essentially, with very different phenomenology. So that's the most general thing you can do. This lambda bar is essentially an effective cosmological constant, which is my bare cosmological constant, whatever I stack into my action, plus a piece that, as you can see, depends on this parameter of the ether. And this parameter determines the asymptotic behavior of the ether to a large extent. Essentially, these are stationary axisymmetric solutions. So I have a time-like Killing vector at infinity. And this B is a measure of the potential misalignment of the ether vector with a time-like Killing vector at infinity, geometrically. So
it could be zero.
It could be zero. I could set it to zero. Yeah, and then my cosmological constant, my bare one, will be my actual one. But the interesting thing is, I could actually start with a negative cosmological constant and end up with a positive one, or vice versa, you know, because that doesn't have a definite sign. I can play with the parameters as well. So another issue that I should mention is that this J bar is not positive definite. I mean, in the BTZ solution, you obviously don't have an ether, but in the BTZ solution, you have J equals J bar, right? And J square is manifestly positive. Here it's not true. Just by making psi larger than one, I could make J bar as negative as I want, right? And that will make a big difference. So let me just say a couple of words about the BTZ spacetime. So if J were equal to J bar, the metric would be BTZ, and BTZ space is actually locally ADS. It's isometric to ADS at every point. So it's kind of like taking ADS space, having cutting off a wedge and glued it back together. This is not the case here. So if I go and calculate the curvature invariance for my for the spacetimes, you'll see that you actually have genuine curvature singularities at the origin, as long as J bar and J are not the same. So in the BDZ case, this wouldn't be the case. And the central singularity is not a curvature singularity, it's some sort of causal singularity. You can't extend geodesic past that, but it's not a curvature singularity. Here, it's a genuine curvature singularity. And here you see, as long as the effective cosmological constant is not zero, you actually see that there is a very rich behavior of the various solutions, where you can have one or two horizons. You can have singularities which are space-like or time-like, depending on how many horizons you have. You actually have black hole solutions with De Sitter asymptotics, not only anti-De Sitter asymptotics. And more importantly, you actually have black hole solutions with flat asymptotics as well. So I could either choose the cosmological constant. Let me go back. I can either choose lambda and B to be zero a priori, or I can just tune them to cancel out the effective cosmological constant. And I could get, I could get solutions with flat asymptotics. That's a typical example. So that's a nice one parameter, it's a nice three parameter solution, which is a metric with flat asymptotics. I could actually set this B to zero so that the ether doesn't have any asymptotic divergences in its components. And it would be, then it would become very, very similar to the solutions that we already know in three dimensions. Actually, it's sort of like a five-dimensional Schwarzschild spacetime. I'm judging that from the scaling of the term here. So if we were in five dimensions, if you had two extra angular coordinates, and I would set the rotation to zero, that would be the mass essentially of the black hole. But no, but because this J square can be negative. So, if J square were positive, that wouldn't be a black hole, right? Because clearly you wouldn't be able to have a horizon. But I'm assuming that J bar is negative.
So you can make J zero and J bar squared positive.
I can make J equal zero and I can make J bar negative, J bar square negative. So I make J zero, I make psi larger than one, and J bar is negative. Psi is one of the parameters of the theory, can be more than one without a problem.
Nothing bad happens.
No. Psi equals one is the value of GR. You know, it would be the typical value that you have in GR. So usually psi equals one is.
What is the prime? I'm a bit confused about that because, I mean, in Hadamard lifts, if you set psi equals zero, then there is no other free parameter. So, you could just.
That's not true. In Hadamard lifts, there are three parameters, lambda, psi, and eta. You could set it to one. You could actually set that you're perfectly right in that. I could actually set psi to one by redefining the metric and mixing it with the ether. So there is a disformal transformation that I could do that sets psi to one. But then I'm going to another metric. So I'm talking about the geometry of that metric, which is not the same as this one. So but it's actually an interesting point because you see that the two metrics will not have the same structure, the same causal structure. They won't even share singularity, the nature of the singularities. Because when I set psi to one, J and J bar are identical. So my singularities stop even being curvature singularities and so on. But I wanted to study this metric just because I want to see the analogy between this metric, which is which I would potentially couple to matter minimally if I was in four dimensions, essentially, right? If I switch the metric, I'm probing a different causal structure. So let me, since I've already gone over time, let me just very quickly say some of the characteristics of these solutions. So far I talked about standard horizons. The important thing would be universal horizons here. And the point is, first of all, they don't always exist. Even in spherically symmetric solutions, they don't always exist. They do exist in most solutions, but they don't always exist. So if you take the flat space that I showed you before, And you set B equal to zero and J equals to zero, sorry, the flat asymptotic solution, and you set B equal to zero and J equal to zero, which will be a circularly symmetric, asymptotically flat solution. It won't have a universal horizon. That shows that it's not a generic feature of every solution. On the other hand, they do exist in solutions that have rotation, arbitrarily high rotation, right? When they exist, these horizons are not always regular. So these A and B parameters can all, if I want to have solutions with regular universal horizons, and I want to be able to extend the foliation beyond the universal horizon, I might have to impose conditions between A and B. So I might have to reduce my 5-parameter family to a 4-parameter family. And this typically happens because the ether, essentially, hits zero on one of the components of the ether hits zero on the universal horizon. And without any condition, it might actually turn imaginary after that, which actually signals that the foliation cannot be continued after that. So the solution would end there. If you don't want that to happen, you might have to tune the parameters of the solution. Here it's not though, because this foliation is a global feature of the theory. No, you can't do anything. It's intrinsic to the theory. It's a fundamental foliation.
It's a significant difference between two.
Yeah, exactly. This is the significant difference. I mean, this is a theory with a preferred foliation, Horava gravity, right? And so these are solutions to Horava gravity, by the way, not Einstein ether theory. So this theory has a preferred foliation. That's its main characteristic. So, and that's what you see here, how this foliation behaves. You cannot undo it with a coordinate transformation or anything like that. It's just fundamental. And another interesting feature of these solutions is that there exist solutions with universal horizons, which are not behind black hole horizons, but beyond the Sitter horizons. So they are essentially of cosmological nature. And all of these behaviors are summarized in this Penrose diagram. So, I mean, that's a Penrose diagram for a solution with ADS asymptotics, a typical solution with ADS asymptotics that has a universal horizon. That's one for the Sitter asymptotics, and that's one for flat asymptotics. And these orange lines are universal horizons. So are the Sitter black holes typically don't have universal horizons inside that cloak the singularity, but can have cosmological type universal horizons. That's a typical black hole. So it's very similar to the diagram I showed you before from four dimensions from the decoupling limit by Vlas and Sibiryakov. And that's the ADS one where the universal horizon instead is sitting between two standard horizons, the outer and the inner one, because that's a rotating black hole solution. So these dashed lines, actually, which you see here, essentially, which are sitting on past null surfaces, past horizons, are actually indicate that the foliation there tries to become null. So it's questionable whether I should be drawing these maximal extensions in the way I'm drawing them, because it's not clear that you can just pass from here to there. Right, but that's why we made them dashed lines, to be clear that you might not have to draw that. You can always draw the maximal extension of the metric. The question is if the ether, if the way you foliate it allows it to be a continuous space. So let me summarize. So I believe that black holes are of great interest in Lorentz breaking theories, and this new notion, the notion of a universal horizon, which allows you to extend the notion of black hole in a theory with infinite propagation speed, is something worth understanding further. The examples I've showed you so far show that the universal horizon survives rotation in Horava gravity, because there's always a preferred foliation. And would be, of course, very interested to see what happens in rapidly rotating black holes there. It raises questions about Einstein ether theory, because as I told you, in slowly rotating black holes in Einstein ether theory, you don't have black holes that admit a foliation, a global foliation. That doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have this type of universal horizons, but it's not, you know, it makes it hard to tell. So that's one thing we're looking into together with Ian and Enrico Barrausen. The three-dimensional examples are nice in the sense that they're telling you that, at least from the point of view of the solutions you can just generate, it's not every time you have a killing horizon, you're going to find a universal horizon behind it, right? And you can also find it beyond the Sitter horizons and so on. So on the one hand, the feature might be more generic. On the other hand, it's less. So you really have to understand how these horizons form, potentially from collapse, when, under which conditions. I mean, there is some work done by Niayas and collaborators here on this matter. And of course, there is the question of stability that I raised. If this structure might exist with all these symmetries, is it actually a stable structure? So that's about it. Thanks.
Want to be able to verify, falsify all of this parameter. Yeah. There are no data to demonstrate the resonance of binding. However, the binding pulsar, the monopole dipole radiation excluded to a high degree of accuracy. Here you have 3 degrees of freedom at 0 to 1. So
the binary pulsar constraints have been worked out actually for Horava gravity, yeah. And they shrink the parameter space a lot, but there is still some region. Else. Yeah, the big question there is, I mean, if we're going to talk about viability of the theory in this sense, the big question there is not if you can satisfy the current infrared constraints. These have more or less been worked out. The question is, are the values that you need to give these parameters to satisfy the infrared constraints compatible with, you know, the behavior that you expect the theory to have as a remnant of its UV. So you go calculate how these parameters flow as you go to the IR. Do they actually go to these values? Because this is supposed to be Horava gravity. I mean, aspires to be some a UV complete theory, which is not clear yet. So, sorry.
I agree, it's not clear. So how do you falsify?
Well, as I said, at the moment we've tested most of the things we could test. So far, there is a small region of the parameter space that remains. But I mean, you can say that the theory at the IR, the theory is predictive, right? I mean, it has three couplings. You predicted something. You were predicting things that were not there to some extent. You had to tune the parameters. Then you have to see if these values of the parameters are technically natural from a point of view of UV completion. That's something that remains to be done. So you need to calculate RG flows and so on and so forth.
Another quick question. TR when the observer freely falls through the subplatform, and he or she does not detect the horizon. If the horizon is singular, they will know this is horizon.
Why are you saying that the horizon is singular?
You said they're not regular.
No, I said they're not always regular in all solutions. And you have to actually tune the parameters to make them regular.
Well, you do.
Yeah, but if you tune, so I gave you a 5-parameter family. My statement was that in this 5-parameter family, a generic solution won't necessarily have a regular, not even a regular horizon. I mean, it won't necessarily have a regular universal horizon. But if it has any, because it just might not have a universal horizon in the first place. If it has a universal horizon, it might not be regular, but there is a subset of solutions which form a 4-parameter family for which the horizons are regular. So for these, I mean, you don't have this problem.
Could you take some kind of Laporte thermodynamics
here in the theory? Yeah, that's a long discussion on whether you should be doing thermodynamics on these universal horizons, and I mean, there are some thermodynamical conundrums essentially that you can build with the multiple horizons of the individual modes and so on. So I mean, that's an active field of research. Yeah.
I have a technical question. So when you showed the expression for the temperature invariance, if you take the parameters b to zero, are the solutions like?
No. There is still a xi sitting in the denominator of. Oops, sorry. The parameter b just refers to the rescaling of the cosmological constant, right? The curvature invariants depend on the difference of the j's. But even if you set a to zero, there is still a xi sitting in the denominator of that. So the difference is still not one. You'd actually have to go to psi equals one to kill this, to change the character of the singularity.
So in only one particular metric, the curvature singularity.
Yeah, exactly. Which is an ad hoc metric. It doesn't. It's
right.
Not the metric that, you know, in which any degree of freedom propagates. It's just
right.
Some wild redefinition you can.
Right. Okay, since there is another talk in almost 15 minutes down by one floor on a similar topic, I suggest